What's up, everybody? Michael Carlieri, Timothy John Stafford, your humble hosts of the Voxology podcast. Welcome. We hear a lot from those of you who are newer to the podcast, and so we just want to say a couple of things. First of all, prepare to be disappointed. And secondly,
what does she say in Spider-Man? Like, if you just set yourself up for, if you expect disappointment, you're never.
Yeah, you're never whatever. Disappointed. Yeah. If you lower your expectations, key to life, lowered expectations, marriage, parenting, the whole thing.
That's our mission bio.
Dramatically lowering the expectations of people about podcasts, Voxology. Anyway, hello. I'm coming fresh off a stint in the news segment of the Holy Post podcast.
This is true. I listened.
This is true. I know you're so nice. You're so nice. And you always are like, hey, I really enjoyed whatever. And thank you, Timothy. Love what they're up to. There's some great podcasts out there. The Bema one with Marty Solomon. I'm not current on that. Obviously, we love the Gombas. We love the Holy Post. Caitlin, I think, is doing her own. Excuse me. So we're stoked about that. Seth Erie needs one. I've thought about the Seth cast. We've talked about it before. But I want to say a couple of things. First of all, thank you for all of you who have been emailing in. And this the parenting thing has struck a chord. Mm-hmm. Oh, my word. And so thank you for all of you emailing in. I don't know. I've been thinking about, you know, do we want to explore that a little more? Do we do like a different stream of the podcast? Not sure.
Well, one of the things you and I talked about, and I maybe listeners can email in about this, is that for me, in reading those emails, it seems like there's something about the practicality of living out, like the parenting thing was a good vehicle to look at the practicality of what it means to be like a Christian within a very like real world environment rather than just like kind of speculative.
That's
theories
right.
And that kind of stuff. So I wonder if that's part of it, is just like leaning into this.
Yep.
This is me on a day to day at my worst or whatever.
Yeah. Stuff like vocation, marriage, date, like relationship. Yeah. And I get why the preaching format of kind of TED Talk advice about how to have healthy relationships and stuff, why there's like this never ending hunger for that. But I don't know that we always do a good job of connecting that stuff to some of the headier stuff about what story are we inhabiting, how it is we see the gospel and the kingdom and, you know, blah, 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 how we see God's, you know, attitude towards us. So anywho, the second thing I want to say thank you is that for whatever reason, a whole bunch of you are joining Patreon. We have redone our reward tiers. We have someone actually administrating them.
That's the key.
And
that's the key,
which
note.
Is
somebody else.
We key.
Have somebody else.
We have a
organized
merch store on Etsy, but if you want merch, those are some of the reward tiers. So we don't like talking about money stuff, just except to say we are 501c3, we are a nonprofit, we are crowdfunded. And it's just always encouraging when people see this as something they find valuable enough to support. So if you're interested
in
that.
And the merch doesn't go in our pockets. We didn't set up the merch store for us to buy new shoes. Some of those new Trump gold shoes. We set it up to like help support things like the Nonference and other ministries that we're interested in supporting.
Yeah, you all actually have been asking for a merch store. So Timothy, you know.
It's
did
here.
It. We love. I mean, we're on Etsy, which is a very masculine place. I don't know. Gender stereotypes.
I spent a lot of time on Etsy. So yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Tim. Tim Stafford today, we were just before we hit record, we were talking about therapy. As we do, yes. Two middle-aged men in therapy. And you were saying that you had an interesting conversation. You were feeling your mortality. Mm-hmm. And we were joking because, you know, we joke around about being two middle-aged white guys. And Tim will often say, I don't kind of look at myself as middle-aged. But then off air, we were talking about his gallbladder and his colon. So that's the sure sign that you're middle age is when you're discussing those sorts of things. But I thought what your therapist said in response to a point you brought up was really interesting. So could you repeat that? You were processing your mortality, your feelings of mortality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a bunch of little health things that all popped up at the same time. And so I was talking to my wife first about how all of that makes you, I was just thinking about mortality because you do that when you have health problems, and then how I feel like I haven't done anything with my life yet. I don't feel like I'm, and I was telling the therapist that, and like, I don't feel like I've done anything yet. And I don't feel like, how did I just say that? That I'm not great at anything, but I'm pretty decent or maybe good at a couple things, but I don't feel great at anything. And I don't know what my whatever is. And she was like, she's been pushing me a lot towards, doing spiritual direction work or coaching work. And so she was hammering on that again a lot, because I was telling about conversations and stuff that I'd had with students and a couple other people the couple days prior to therapy. And she was telling me that I do have gifts. I'm just using them in a multiple, like a bunch of different places, not just in one. So like, if you think of like, you know, this is a generic idea, but if you're like, I'm a really good basketball player, I have a gift of playing basketball, and I became a pro basketball player with my life, I exercised my gift in the arena that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us think about it that way. And so when I was looking at them, like, I'm teaching, I'm doing a podcast, I'm doing these things. I don't feel like I'm doing
Don't say that disdainfully, Tim.
I'm doing teaching. I'm doing a podcast. And I don't know. And she's just like, you're using that gift, your gift all over the place. You're just not recognizing it. So it may sound dumb in hindsight, but in the moment I was like, oh, all right.
I think that's first, that's so true.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of us, you know, we're constantly surrounded by achievement culture.
Yes.
You know, we've got to get our hustle on. And like when Paul says, hey, make it your ambition to live a quiet life, work with your hands so that you're not dependent on anybody. Like, there's no teaching ever on that. We've always got to do great things for God and great things in life. And so her answer, though, is that you're already doing great things. It's just some of us have a very narrow lane where that is expressed, and some of us have a very broad lane where that is expressed. And you
all those lanes are kind of crashing into each other now, too, where it's like I feel that way, but we've been sorting through some like kind of small T trauma stuff from my upbringing, whether it's in the evangelical church or being boxed in by everybody that, what you've talked about on here, and being told you can't do these things, don't do these things. And now I'm in therapy where she's trying to unlock me doing a lot of these things, but it feels in my DNA as though I can't, because after 40 something years, that has been, it's part of me now, this disbelieving, this trauma, all these things that have become a part of who I am. So unraveling that is obviously A, painful, and then B, like just disorienting, confusing, etc. So when she was talking about leaning in these things or understanding these things, I'm like, I don't understand that, because I don't experience it or see it on a day-to-day basis. I feel conflict over those things because I feel guilty about them, which then leads us into shame and false guilt and that kind of stuff.
Let me say this though. Let me just say this. Sometimes I forget. Oh, hold on a second. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a half day.
Yes.
It is a house day for House Coreticus, which I'd love someone to explain what that is to me.
All those words.
And it is the beginning of spring break for one very happy Seth Thomas Charles Ear.
Vacation.
What's up, everybody? What's up? So, Seth, what are we going to do over a break?
Well, after a good break, I'm going to see Nate.
We're going to go see Nate, our oldest. Yep.
I'll play soccer.
Yeah, he's going to play soccer. So
I was Dayton.
Vacation in Dayton, Ohio, which is amazing this time of year. Are we going to chill?
Yes.
Seth's favorite thing to do is chill.
See ya.
Yes. Yeah,
me too.
Money up.
Yeah, money up. There
syndrome
it is.
Down.
Money up.
Yeah.
Syndrome
money
down.
Money up.
Money up.
That's right.
Yeah.
Do you think Tim is a good listener?
Yes.
Thank you.
Do you think he comes across a very safe person?
Oh, gosh, no.
Okay, well, I disagree with that one. How about, do you think he asks good questions?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it's a big shout-out.
Yeah, and we do big shout-outs to Tim. Absolutely. Shout-outs out. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
A big shout-out to Intipi and Brenda.
Andy Bear and Brenda. Man, whoa. You got to be an old-school listener to know those. Deep, yes, deep and hole. Tim. Deep, yep, deep cuts. Yep.
Tim, go ahead.
Hey, Sethy.
Yeah?
Your Zaxby's is here.
Hey, Tim, go ahead.
What's he going to do? Is he going to do shout-outs? What do you want him to do?
Tim is still with the big shout-out first.
Okay, right, Tim, you got to do a couple shout-outs, bro.
Shout-out to Seth Erie, Nate Erie, and Hannah Erie.
What?
And big shout-out to Tim Gombas.
And Tim Gombas.
And to my kitchen.
And my turn?
Yes.
Shout-out to Tim Stafford.
Yes.
Tim Gombas.
Yep.
Tim Timmons.
Yep,
Timothy Jones. Timothy, the understudy of the Apostle Paul. Tiny Tim.
Tiny Tim.
God blesses everyone.
Yes.
Timothée Chalamet.
All right, buddy. Hey, you're Timothée Chalamet. Your Zaxby's here. Go get it and go bring it to Hannah. All right. Love you.
Remember too.
See you, bro.
Peace out, guys.
Peace out, guys. Nice. Seth Erie, dude. All of 15. Every bit of 15 years old. But regardless of Seth's opinion of you, I think I speak for many when I say, dude, you're one of the safest people I've ever been around. Yeah. You're a truth teller. You ask great questions and you're a really good listener, which like that there's some superpower right there. And that doesn't get rewarded in evangelical culture.
Right.
And it's so dumb that it doesn't. So, but I'm proud of you. I mean, what's nice is that in my therapy, I just talk about you. So I'm fine. I'm fixed. Yes. Thank you very much. And yep, Seth, you don't have to show off Zaxby's to YouTube. You do not.
Sorry.
No. If you don't know what Zaxby's is, I can't describe it. It's a thing. Today, finally, we're going to start. So at the church I'm at in Tennessee, we've been going like verse by verse over Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And it's beautiful in a church because you can make certain assumptions about your audience. And there's like the purpose of our teaching is to go into the Lord's Supper. And so, you know, blah, blah, blah. But there's so much that gets cut out that just can't fit in a 30-minute deal. And then I have all of this like massive, massive amount of material about what it is to be human that's sitting there, that's on the cutting room floor, so to speak. And then in my therapy, and then in our non-friends last year, it's kind of started this whole thing. We've talked a lot about how it is that that some expressions of Christianity dehumanize us. And so, and dehumanize means we're not allowed, like it can happen in so many ways. We're not allowed to listen to secular music. We're not allowed to ask questions. We're not allowed to be angry. We can never just sit in pain or disappointment with God. We always have to end it in a pretty red bow. We can never disagree with each other. We never can make Jesus look bad. I mean, there are just lots of ways. Like I was never told what the body is for. I was always told what to be against from the body, right? So the body, all the appetites you've got, be against those. I was never told what they were for. And so there are these large segments, especially when you just have a gospel that only is concerned with getting your soul to a disembodied state called heaven. There are whole segments of human life that are just sort of not fodder for thought or reflection or theology or whatever, or discipleship. And, you know, the goal of, and maybe it's different now, you know, with people talking more about spiritual disciplines and mental health, I don't know. But in my circles and growing up, if the goal was to get your soul into heaven, then the rest of what you did was just to say no. You know, there were no human yeses. And so therapy has been this process for me of kind of like recovering what it is to be human, you know? And totally. And I know that sounds, I don't know how it sounds, so maybe cliche, but it's been really life-changing for me. And then you add the paid professional religious person on top of that, and then there's another deep cut of not being able to be real and human. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, hey, why don't we spend some time talking theologically first? Because I think Genesis 1, 2, and 3 gives a biblical anthropology that is so bigger and better than anything I initially encountered in evangelical culture. And here's the big point, depending on how and where you start the human story will determine what you think Jesus comes to do.
Yes, totally.
So if it's a sin problem in Genesis 3, then Jesus comes to solve sin. But if it's a restoration problem that comes from Genesis 1 and 2, then Jesus, and we've made these points before, but you know, for some reason our community has tolerated these really long arcing conversations like Sermon on the Mount or like Revelation.
Yeah.
And I thought, I am utterly fascinated and have been greatly renewed by understanding some things in Genesis. And so I was like, I'd love to do this. And Tim, you know, you've been wanting to really look at the humanity of Jesus forever.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping we can just spend some time and it'll get super practical in terms of mental health, sexuality, understanding limitations, weakness, absolutely. But for a little bit, I just thought I'd love to marinate in these early chapters of Genesis that provide one way of understanding what it is to be human. And actually, once we've explored all the nooks and crannies, I actually think it's really the most compelling picture out there of what it is to be fully human. I really do. And it frames then why it's so important that Jesus of Nazareth was human.
Right.
And what he does in his humanness and not in his divinity, that's the point.
Yeah, I'm excited.
At least two of us are.
Well,
Seth's game for anything, so three of us.
For anybody who has joined Patreon and doesn't know, we have a Facebook group, like a private Facebook group on Facebook. People will ask questions, and it's not as active as it could be, but I think it's a great spot because it's private to have conversations. But one of the conversations that recently just happened was about, that it delved into things about like hell and judgment, but also atonement theories, but it provokes all these, like, it's just so interesting because everything you just said, I think all those implications reverberate out into all of that. Like,
yeah.
Because someone's like, well, what if you don't think about this, then what about this? And it's like, well, then you have to define this, you have to define this, you have to define this, you have to define this. Like all those things.
Totally.
They all link to each other. So I think it's an exciting conversation to pick up.
They really do. They really do. Now, so thank you. I hope it's helpful and good. But I even think the parenting conversation was an expression of this. Like,
absolutely. It's very human.
Yeah. Yeah. I could keep going. Okay, so what I want to do today is just talk about what Genesis is and what it's not. Now, we learned this in Revelation, and we talked about this way back in our long Bible series, but the Bible will tell you how to read it, you should never be reading it flatly. Because it's different genres of literature written in different periods of human history with different aims, the worst possible thing we could do is to open up an English Bible and say, what does this mean to me? That is the absolute worst question. Not because it should mean something to you, but rather what it will mean to you has to be congruent with how the original audience would have heard this. Mm-hmm. Because obviously the Bible was written for us, but not to us. And that distinction is really, really important. We learned this in Revelation, right? The first conversation in Revelation was like 3 weeks or 4 weeks of genre, apocalyptic genre, prophetic genre, epistle writing genre, like, and that is where the whole battle is fought in terms of understanding Revelation. And so too with Genesis. And so I want to just spend a little time illustrating a couple things out of the first verse of the Bible to say, I don't think Genesis is meant to be a scientific account of the material origins of the universe.
What?
Now, we'll have a Genesis book list out there if you're interested. But there are so many people doing such good work on this. If you're more academically inclined, there's a guy named John Walton who has done, he's got a like the lost world of Genesis 1, the lost world of Adam and Eve, the lost world of the flood, the lost world of the Israelite conquest. Like, it is absolutely incredibly important stuff that he's contributing to how it is that these ancient documents functioned in the ancient Near East. And we have loads of parallels with other creation stories that we can draw certain inferences from. And so all of his stuff, Tim Mackey and the Bible Project, I cannot recommend just all of that stuff like highly enough. If you're looking for something to show your kids, if you're looking for a way to have a devotional life and you're just not into the Bible, click on their 6-minute thematic videos and just soak it in. I think they have a podcast like where they do like Q and questions and answers and stuff out of that. I don't know exactly how it works, but I find Tim's done so much great stuff in Genesis, and he channels so many great scholars. I just recommend that as a. Him, Tim Mackey. Yes,
Muehlhoff. What was
it? Yeah. Muehlhoff, yeah, that's right. There's another one. And I would also recommend, there's a guy named Richard Middleton who wrote a book called The Imago Dei, Liberating the Imago Dei, I think is the name of it. That is absolutely phenomenal. Gombas has stuff on this. There's just loads out there. So, and I get so pumped. It's been so fun talking through some of this stuff at our church, but I'm really excited to kind of blow the doors off in terms of like, there's a lot that's still out there to cover. Yep. So the first verse of the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What could be more simple than that? Right? And so it's so clear in English. Let's move on. The problem, of course, is when I hear the word heaven, I think of it in the singular, not mm-hmm. the plural. And then I think of a disembodied place where souls go when they die and live forever with God. That's what I think of when I think of heaven, right? I mean, that's like the imaginative lens through which we have looked at this. Your soul goes to heaven. That's where God is. And there are streets of gold and there are mansions and, you know, it's really a disembodied sort of place. Somewhere else, in some other dimension. It's not like if you go out into space far enough, you'll find heaven. It's a whole other spiritual dimension. And then earth, you know, I can't help but think of earth as a pale blue dot floating into space. And Tim Mackey asked just a wonderful question. When did we get that idea of the pale blue dot? Well, the photo that's most referenced came, I think it was in 1963. And so we've only been thinking of pale blue dots floating in black nothingness, you know, until that point or from that point. And so it's interesting when you just take heaven and earth and to pay attention to how much we've preloaded what those things mean with what to us is a very natural way of looking at the world, right? The universe is full of floating balls of gas and planets and moons, and we're one of those. Mm-hmm. And heaven is this place in Christian theology where invisible souls go when the body dies. And it's just like, well, yeah, okay, so God made heaven and earth. Perfect. The Hebrew sort of behind this doesn't carry sort of the same nuance, what? Shockingly. I know. I know. And so imagine you lived in a world where, like, you didn't have any pale blue dot imagery. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have some disembodied spiritual dimension imagery. But rather, you just stood on a hillside, you know, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, looking at the vast array of stars, and you went, oh, in the beginning, God created what's down here and what's up there. And that's what the words literally mean. Like, earth is eretz, or land, it's the land where my feet are. And then heaven is shemayim, which is like the sky up there. So in the beginning, God created what's up here.
And what's down here.
Yeah, what's up there and what's down here. Okay, now, a little note, this functions also as something called a merism, which is a literary device. Like when I say, hey, Amazon sells everything from A to Z, and that's what their logo means. A to Z, when I reference the two poles of something, that means they sell everything in between, right? Mm-hmm. By referencing the two extremes, I'm referencing everything. So right. If I say, you know, Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega, it's like every title that's good is included in Alpha yeah. and Omega. Alpha and Omega is a merism. A to Z is a merism. Well, heaven and earth is a merism too. It's a way of saying in the beginning, God created everything. But I wanted to draw attention to the heaven and earth bit, because without thinking about it, I think of earth as a globe, mm-hmm. and I think of heaven as a place of disembodied bliss. And that's what I think was created. And it's actually, nope. In the beginning, God created what's down here and what's up there. Perfect. Now, when did he create those things? And the first word is Bereshit, and the root of that is a word called Reshit. And I'm getting this from a guy named John Salehammer, who is another amazing Genesis scholar. When we hear the phrase beginning in English, we think of a linear sequence that has a defined starting point, right? So I'm going to begin counting. Right. One, two. When was the beginning? When I started at one.
One.
Right? So the beginning represents a linear sequence or a chronology. They have a word that refers to a point in time that starts something, a singular point in time. That's not this word. All right? And this is Salehammer. He wrote a book called Genesis Unbound. And this was the first place I saw this, but Walton gets into this too. Reshit is a... It doesn't refer to a point in time. It refers to a beginning piece of time. So it could be like saying way back when, or a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It could be, we don't know how long ago. That's not what, no one's trying to answer how long ago this is. When you hear a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, you're not asking, oh, where is that? And when was that? Right, Reshit functions this way. It's a way of capturing something that happened before the thing I'm really interested in gets going. Hmm. So a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away doesn't tell you anything. It just says, hey, this sets the table for the action that I'm really interested in, but it doesn't give us any specifics about that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So let me give you a couple examples. So in Job, if you, Job, are pure and upright, God will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. This is after he's lost his home, his family, everything. Even though your reshit, beginning, was insignificant, your end will be very great. Now, here, Reshit does not refer back to a point in time. It refers back to the whole period of time when Job's life was good. Mm-hmm. The book of Job opens. Job was a righteous man, and here's what he had. But that's not what Job's interested in, or the book of Job's interested in. It's interested in when this, you know, this like heavenly wager takes place, and then Job loses everything in his response.
So it's not when Job was born. It's not the beginning of Job.
Exactly. It's not referring to the point in time when he began.
Right.
It's referring to the period of time before he suffered. And that's not a singular point in time. We don't know how many years that was.
Right.
Right? So in the same way I could refer to the end of his life, well, that can mean a point in time like the moment he dies, or the end of his life could be the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. So Reshit is not a reference to the singular point in time the universe started. God created all that's up there and all that's down here in the Reshit, Bereshit, which means way back when he did creating. Now, let's get this story started with the chaotic sea. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't refer to a singular point in time. Another example of this. In fact, Reshit just describes an undescribed period of time before the thing that we're going to focus on right now happens. Jeremiah 21, in the Reshit of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Josiah, king of Judah, this word came to Jeremiah. So in the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, does that mean when he just took, the moment he took office? No. In fact, in the next chapter we read, now in the same year, in the Reshit of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the fourth year, in the fifth month. So the Reshit described the period of at least 4 years of the early reign of Zedekiah, right? So that was the beginning of his reign. But it wasn't a singular point in time. It was an unspecified, vague period of time that does get specified here, but not specified in Job. That just refers to the stuff that happened before we start our story, right? So once upon a time, the minute you hear that, I know a fairy tale is coming.
Right.
And they lived happily ever after. Those function the same way. We don't know like how long the ever after was. That's not the point of bringing up happily ever after or once upon a time. No one's sitting there going, well, when? And the reason I bring this up is because Reshit is not a specification of a unit of time.
Right.
So it's fascinating that the questions that we ask in 21st century America, we ask Genesis to answer, are how long ago,
right,
and how it happened. And right. How did it? Yes. How long ago did it happen, and how did it happen? And as we'll see, not just today, but like throughout the whole thing, the author of Genesis isn't answering those questions. The author of Genesis is answering, what did God create and why did he create? It's the difference between metaphysics and physics. So physics is the study of the material ordering of the universe down to its most basic components. Metaphysics answers the questions about what? Why? Why do things exist when they didn't have to? You know, physics can tell us all about how thunderstorms happen, but physics can't answer why we find them so awe-inspiring. You know what I mean? Like metaphysics deals with the questions of existence and truth and meaning and purpose. And that's what the writer of Genesis is really interested in.
So in differentiating those two different ways of looking at time, you are learning how to posture yourself for the information that's coming after.
Correct. So if by deconstructing the first sentence, I mean, we're not even getting into the word bara, which is create.
Yeah.
Walton does this thing about bara that means to create in the ancient Near Eastern world doesn't mean to bring into physical existence. It means to name and order something and give it a purpose and function in an ordered system.
Yeah.
And so just these, just this
the,
first
just the
sentence.
First half of the first sentence
tells you that Genesis isn't answering modern scientific questions. So it's kind of like the writer saying, hey, way back when God started creating, he created everything. Now let's talk about the land and the chaotic sea.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there's some English translations that pick up on that. Now let's talk about, like my NIV has that. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness and water covered, you know, covered the deep and the whatever.
Does that change the way like the, and you can say, shut up if this is jumping ahead, but like everything that follows that is a sequence of events.
Is it?
So, okay.
So yes. So people will say, bro, it is introducing a chronology. Look, we've got seven things happening. Mm-hmm. And we don't have time to get into all of that, but because it's not all relevant to being human. But there are several things that happen. First of all, seven isn't a chronology. If we have time, we're going to look at seven is, it's two things. It's a temple initiation ceremony. But seven also, there are so many sevens in Genesis chapter one, that seven also functions as a marker for something mm-hmm. else. And so the point of Reshit is to tell us, I'm not interested in telling you when the 7 days took place. The 7 day motif is a motif in the ancient world that communicates something else. Mm-hmm. So Reshit is a way to say, hey, way back when, before the action started, God did something. He created everything. But what I'm interested in is that the land was formless and empty. Mm-hmm. So Reshit does not answer, when did that happen? Because in Job, we just find out the whole beginning of his life was Reshit. And with Zedekiah, the whole beginning of his reign was Reshit. Now, we happen to hear that it's 4 years. And with Job, we have no idea, but and the Salehammer gets into a lot of this. There are other words that mean point in time. And so to ask, hey, how long ago did the Big Bang happen? Or let's add up all of the genealogies in the Bible and say, okay, so the earth is 6,000 years old and we're going to die in that hill. The problem that this addresses, and again, there's so much more scholarship here than what I'm alluding to. I just wanted to take the first sentence and say, look at how easily misunderstood the first sentence is. In the beginning, which means a singular point in time that we can discern when. God created, which means he brought into physical existence. He brought in the globe and the disembodied place we all go where he lives when we die. You've already packed it full of automatically a whole bunch of 21st century assumptions.
Totally.
And then we're told that unless you understand Genesis as six or seven literal days that happened 6,000 years ago, and that the earth is very, very young and the flood was global and whatever else, then you're not taking the Bible seriously. But then we have science who's saying, look, no, I think the earth is billions of years old. And that humanity didn't show up fully formed, but showed up and like evolved over the course of time. And I don't mean evolved in like the like incredible like macro evolutionary way that's going to offend people, but clearly humans evolve and grow and change over the course of time. And so we're told science is antithetical to faith because faith tells us that God did this in, 6 days and then a seventh day he rested. And then science tells us, well, it actually happened over a longer time. So the two can't ever get together.
Right.
And the problem with that is they both assume Genesis is trying to answer mm-hmm. the how did it happen and when did it happen questions.
Then they're opposed with each other because of that.
That's right. Because they give two different answers to the same set of questions. And what I'm trying to suggest is that's not what Genesis is answering at all.
Yeah.
It's not telling us how, and it's not telling us when. It's going to tell us what. What did God make? Everything. Everything God made. And why he made it.
Yeah.
So that difference, the difference between physics and metaphysics. So when we get to the humans like being made of dust, that's not an origin story of God collecting dust and forming a human. It is a story about how from the dust is a way of saying that something is frail or it's mortal. So the human beings are mortal. Like in our essence, we're mortal, which means there had to be a tree of life and availability to the tree of life for us to have the opportunity to escape mortality, which also means then that our souls are not by definition immortal so that we roast in hell forever. Hmm. So like there are all sorts of things that follow from some of the
totally. This, the you're setting up a posture from which you either, it's like that Genesis point, pun intended, where one line goes this way and one line goes this way. And the further you follow those lines, the, you know, the more distorted yep. some of that imagery or messaging or whatever will be.
Yes. So this one I just wanted, and again, I feel like I have 5 pages of notes that I've just sort of summarized quickly, but they're like thousands of pages of stuff on this that kind of backs this up. But I just wanted to take the first sentence mm-hmm. in English to say the worst thing you can do in Genesis is go, oh, the beginning. Yes, that's so. When did that happen? God created. Oh, that means he brought things into physical existence. And heavens and earth means what heaven and earth mean to us. When you actually dive into it, you're going, oh man, oh, okay. So I've got to approach this the same way I approach every other text, right, with curiosity and humility. And the vast majority of time, oh, Hannah just texted me, who's right next to me. I need to print something out. Well, Hannah, I'm recording a podcast right now. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're ever wondering, you know,
here's parenting this, in real time.
Is this, yeah, is this rehearsed? I think most people probably know.
Yeah.
Probably know.
Everybody wants a glimpse behind the curtain, but the truth is there is no behind the curtain.
There is no curtain. Yeah, exactly right. So, for me, this was revolutionary stuff. I was always taught that science and faith opposed each other. Right. And there are assumptions in each that, you know, can oppose each other. I'm not saying like science is always morally neutral. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I have friends who are biologists and doctors and mm-hmm. physicists, and, you know, for them to just be told, listen, you can't trust any of that stuff. It's, you know, a 6,000-year-old thing. And if you believe that, fine. I don't have an issue if people believe the earth is 6,000 years old because the genealogies and you add them up. The issue I have is when people say that's the only way to take the Bible seriously.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I did conferences this week with my students for their next paper, and it being a Christian university, there's certain topics that when they want to write about them, they feel like they have to write a certain way. And I'm like, listen, I don't care what you think, where you land, but I want you to take your belief and just hold it a little bit out for a second. And when you're doing the research, so you're not doing research through that lens that you already have, that prefabricated lens that you were handed by someone else, to read this stuff and understand it. And then if you land in the exact same position that you held before you did your research, wonderful. But now you know why.
Yep. Yes.
Now you have the reasoning to land where you are. And I said, I don't care what your opinion is. I just want it to be informed.
Yeah.
And I think that's the big thing with a lot of this stuff is I'll get into some of these conversations about these things, and they are the evidence that people want to bring to the conversation is not there. They just say something because they feel it. And it's like, well,
right.
It's also interesting when you think about like a game of telephone over history, like mm-hmm. as people have just orally passed ideas through and how have they changed? And maybe some of those changes weren't even intentional because of the way that that works over time is an interesting thing to look at too. So I'm excited.
I'm really excited
to strip it to the beginning and just be like, okay, what does this look like? Why?
I mean, and we can go slower. I mean, if we want to hit that stuff, like, I mean, we could do a whole thing on Rashid and just show beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's referencing a unspecified period of time before the thing that we're interested in happens. And so, or Barah, I mean, again, that's the big one, man. It's so confusing,
right. But
it's like, why does the human name the animals? Because naming is creating in a sense, you know, it's not that God, I do believe God brings something out of nothing and is the only one that can do that. But I don't know that Genesis 1 demands that we read it that way.
Right.
If
that's the point of it.
If that's the point. Exactly. Exactly.
That's what's interesting is like, what is the point? What is it that God wants to articulate through this weird system that he set up of like humans in these positions at certain periods of time, articulating the story? There is something that wants to come through, but whether it is, like you said, like our understanding of the pale blue dot or that kind of stuff or not, like we are always filtering through these lenses and then things just get so distorted and weird. And then we want to die on those hills.
Exactly. And what we end up doing is we take the worldview assumptions of the ancient world and force them into our world for the sake of being Bible literalists. Mm-hmm. And so when Genesis is going to talk about like the windows of the heavens are opened, or Job talks about the storehouses of hail, or the psalmist will talk about earth resting on pillars. These were very common assumptions in the ancient Near East that God used. But if God was using them to tell us how and when things happened, well, we've learned that they were wrong. But if he were communicating, why and what, then it doesn't matter the particulars of your cosmology. You can use any cosmology to communicate those eternal truths.
That's big.
That is a really big point. Because I've had people come after me and say, well, no, there really is a firmament. And in that firmament or rakia, there are windows into the heavens. And it's like, okay, that's fine. But is Genesis telling us that that is the way that it is? Or is Genesis allowing, in the same way all other pieces of the Bible allow for, the fact that they're using cultural norms and modes of thinking and symbolic universes to convey eternal things about what God is like?
Yeah.
And so if you get hung up on...
Which is so much more interesting.
Oh, it's so much more interesting. The symbolic, and this is where Walton does so much great work, is he introduces you to the symbolic universe of the talking snake. It's not shocking to an ancient person that there's a talking snake in the garden. That is a very common motif. That doesn't mean that that didn't happen or that the Bible copied it, but it just means that in the same way, if I were writing authoritative words, I would be using the forms and the thought forms. If I were writing in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, I'd be talking about a globe. Mm-hmm. Right. You know what I mean? Because that's my understanding of cosmology. Now, if in 2000 years we realize, oh, it's actually something way different and our physics was totally mistaken, okay. That doesn't mean that what was being said was wrong. It just means that we have a better form or more culturally current form in which to express it.
Yeah.
And so, if I were talking, the book of Deuteronomy is a treaty, an ancient treaty form. It follows treaty conventions. We have Assyrian treaties that are outlined just like the book of Deuteronomy. Does that mean anything in the book of Deuteronomy is not true? No, it just means that when God was communicating to ancient people, he used ancient forms to do it.
That's so fascinating.
Right?
Yeah.
And in the same way, let's say God was communicating to the American church and used a constitution, right? To do that, we'd know what a constitution is.
Plus he wrote that, so.
Plus we already have one. Bad example. Yes. But this is a really big point. It's okay to look at Genesis and say, how would the earliest audience have understood this? And guys like Walton and Mackey and Middleton and other, Sailhammer, they're showing from other ancient Near Eastern examples, but also from within the way the Hebrew functions with itself, we're not looking at scientific accounts here. We're looking at theological accounts. And even the chronology, the 1 through 7, is theological. The point isn't, hey, like in Genesis 1, it's the animals and then it's the humans. But in Genesis 2, it's the humans first, then the animals. Oh, there's a contradiction.
Uh-oh.
Not if you're making different theological points.
Right.
And I understand people, there are all sorts of people that have really high degrees of opinion on this. And hallelujah, feel free to disagree. I love what you're saying about your students. The issue isn't have your own opinions. That's great. But Paul says this in Romans. So he's got two house church factions that are disagreeing. I don't know why I'm having trouble with English today. They're disagreeing over lifestyle choices.
You're doing too much in the name of Jesus. In real time.
Yeah, I wish. Or just old, just getting old. They're differentiating was the word I was trying to find there between certain lifestyle choices that they think honor God and other lifestyle choices that a different community thinks honor God. One of those is sacred days. One of those is sacred food. Big deals if you're Jewish. And Paul says to them, let each one be fully convinced in your own mind, but don't judge each other. And that's the part where Genesis has gotten so much light and more heat than light has been in the, you can only take it this one way to take the Bible seriously. And I just every don't way. Think that's true.
You know, and I remember always thinking about that as a negative with so many denominations and different schools of thought on things, and that we were just kind of really broken. More recently, I've been looking at that as kind of like, what if God is bigger than one train of thought? What if the one train of thought is not the goal as much as these why questions, like less the how and the what, and more like, is there something between the Episcopal and the Presbyterian and the Lutheran and the Calvinist and everybody coming to, like, could there be more? I mean, because we do have contentious feelings between the denominations, but what if we didn't have to because of this, like, because there is a mystery element to it that we're using some facet of human cognition to parse out. Does that make sense? Like, does that give us the room for,
I don't know. But we wed ourselves to form. So you take baptism. So clearly baptism is a great example. Baptism is central to the Christian life in what it represents, but it's also a communal practice, all the things. But, you know, we have examples of households that are baptized, including presumably infants. We have examples of single people, like individuals being baptized at one time. We have examples of 3,000 people being baptized at one time. Mm-hmm. Baptized means immerse. And then you have this formula at the end of Matthew, you know, in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. So what we do is we then wed the kernel of baptism to the husk of the form it takes. So it has to be in the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit, or it has to be one time or three times, or it has to be immersion, it can't be sprinkling, or it has to be sprinkling, it has to be an infant, or it has to be an adult. And again, let each one be fully convinced in their own mind. But your point is that it's the heart behind the action, what the theological message it represents, that's the issue. So you can baptize people who are hungry for Jesus in a zillion different ways, in a pool, in a jacuzzi, in a river. You could dunk them once, dunk them three times, dunk them eight times. Great. The mode, the only requirement is that the mode that you do it matches the message that the thing's supposed to convey. You know what I mean? So communion is a shared meal. So when the mode of communion, rich people eating ahead of poor people and shaming them, when the mode violated the message, Paul says people died.
Yeah.
So, but it doesn't say, hey, here are the eight steps to get ready for communion, or here's the liturgy you need to use. So yes, we as people who do not trust God fundamentally, even though we say we do, we would rather have a liturgy. We would rather have authoritative words. We would rather have, right, something that assures me that I'm good and I'm not just wandering around aimlessly.
That's so interesting, because then that really puts that stuff into a different light too. What if we want liturgy for the reason of giving us scaffolding or
handholds?
Yeah. But if we can use liturgy just the different approaches to it, right? So it's whether it is giving you these rules of how to do something so that you can feel like you're accomplishing Christianity or however you want to frame that.
Yeah.
Or liturgy being a way of connecting across time or whatever, it being this other thing that helps reveal rather than giving you the rules and the structure of how to.
Yep.
Is really interesting.
And so too with the structure of the universe. We can receive the worldview of the ancient Near Eastern people about the way of the world. We can receive that worldview and not have to think God didn't know or that all of our modern science is wrong, but we can receive that as like the husk or the form or the skeleton that the theological message of who God is, what God has done, what's wrong, and what God is going to do to remedy it. Those worldview metaphysical questions, like we can receive that, that form, that skeleton as the vehicle through which these theological concepts are communicated.
Yeah.
Right. But like, so like when I talk about redemption, redemption is a slave word coming from slave markets. Mm-hmm. We don't have that anymore. So, you know, if I communicate the gospel using a different image, it's not that I'm violating the gospel. And, and unless you say redemption, it only counts when you say redemption.
Right.
No, no, no. Redemption is communicating an idea that was live in that culture.
Yeah.
Redemption, I mean, I redeem recycling anymore, right? I mean, I can turn in a glass bottle for 5 cents or something. That it just doesn't carry the same freight. And that's where we get into, you know, so much of the splitting and the denominating. And not that we've got it all figured out. I mean, not saying that.
But that's the point.
Yes.
Right?
When you approach the Bible looking at the form or the skeleton or the detail, when the Bible isn't directing you to the form or skeleton or the detail,
right?
What begins to happen is that you cease being curious and humble, and now you have something you have to protect because it's God's word.
Right.
And not just in the theological message, but in the way the theological message happens. Ooh, it's seven literal days. So it's got to be seven literal days. And maybe it is.
But that's not the point.
I'm just saying, reshit means we're not asking the question when.
Right.
Do you Genesis know, like, is not answering
when
that question.
When science figured out the Earth was not the center of the universe, nor even the center of our galaxy or the center of our solar system, did that throw, because that was way after this, obviously. When, like, do you know if that threw, was there like a pushback?
Yes. Oh.
Theologically?
Oh my goodness. Yes. Yes.
So that's interesting, right? Because it's kind of like
church history.
Like, we lock in on something, and then if it gets disproven, you only have two options.
Yeah.
If you're following that framework.
That's right. That's right. And again, I'm all for being appropriately cautious around some assumptions of science that say like the universe is a closed system, nothing miraculous ever happens. Like part of my faith is disagreeing with some of those assumptions. Sure. Absolutely. I think there is a cause to the universe. I don't think it just showed up. And I think it evidences great beauty and intelligence. Of course, I don't think it's random. So I would disagree with, if someone came into science saying, listen, you can't believe that God exists and be a scientist, I'd be like, well, the more I hear about science, the more I believe in God. I mean, it's how it works for me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I don't think the tension between them has to exist at the level of, well, the Bible says the earth rests on pillars. Mm-hmm. And science says it doesn't. So, you know, we have to pick. Yeah. I just don't think that's true. And what the first sentence of Genesis does is two things. First of all, it tells us that I'm all automatically freighting certain words and concepts with 21st century understandings. Mm-hmm. But then secondly, what it means in English isn't always what it means in Hebrew. And so the question then can then be raised, well, all right, so how do we know when we can trust the English or have to look? And that's a separate conversation I don't want to get into right now. But if you're not curious, if you've already determined this is what Genesis means, then you're going to hear this as liberalism or whatever.
That's why I love poetry. That's why it was the focus of my major, because it it makes you do these things. Like I'll do metaphor exercises with my students on the first day of class where it's like, if I say Mike is a lion, what does that mean? But if I say Mike is like a lion, what does that mean? And what connotations
Mike is as cool? a lion?
Yeah. So but it provokes really interesting conversations with them where it's like, it's so basic, but you're right. Like our human brains really like to, whether it's subconsciously or consciously, sometimes both, latch on to like sturdy things and then put everything attach everything to that. And metaphor doesn't let you do that because it makes you think a little bit larger outside of that picture. Like you have to.
And you know what else does that? Is parable.
Exactly.
So when Jesus talks about in parables so much, this is what he's forcing us to do.
Yep.
Right. When he says, hey, a certain man had two sons. No one in the audience is thinking, hey, is that Jethro down there? You know?
Yes. And it forces you to participate, which is something that I really appreciate.
So Genesis is some combination of mythic, poetic narrative that is, it's so much bigger than
that's the thing.
How old the universe is.
Yeah.
It's just that it's not answering that question in my view. Which means when we get to human, okay, the reason this is important is when we get to human, we're going to find ourselves reading certain texts about human in very similar ways.
Yeah.
And we just have to come back to that's not what the author's doing.
Yeah.
Right? So, and you know, so all that is to say, I think this is good enough for week one.
Yeah.
Just to say, hey, what is Genesis? Well, Genesis is a lot like Revelation. Genesis will tell you what it is, but you have to do the work to pay attention. And thankfully, we have huge veins of scholarship that have been around for decades.
Yeah, people that have done
that have no vested interest in like the science versus faith battle, but simply take the text and go, hey, guys, I really don't think this is answering what we all want it to answer.
Well, lastly, too, as we talk about like, again, that email from however long ago that was like, why does it seem like I need a PhD to even open the Bible? I feel like this is an idea of that not being the case necessarily. Like, we may have lost these translations of these words that you're talking about over time. But in getting those, it really does allow you to posture yourself in a sense of longing and mystery and kind of just like being, okay, I'm ready to kind of do this thing. And it doesn't need to be as, because I think the PhD thing implies that you do have to, you're sorting beans almost, you know, like,
right.
There's a correct, a very correct finite scientific answer to everything. And if you just gave me the rule book on what God did, is doing, will do, and where I fit. So I just know my role and I can just put my head down and be whatever. But instead, everyone's being invited into this more wonderful, bigger thing that I don't think you need that.
No.
Does that make sense? But
it totally does, Tim, and I love it because like on the one hand, you're being invited into the national park.
Right.
But on the other hand, the national park is grounded in reality. Mm. And so So for me, the tether and the anchor is Jesus of Nazareth in the Gospels. That is the baseline, rock solid foundation of everything. Jesus is beautiful. He's compelling. He's challenging. He's mysterious. He's confrontive. He's welcoming. He's all the things. He challenges all the views, all the thoughts. If you're broken, he blesses. And if you're proud, he resists. I mean, it's just like, yes. And because I'm secure in my affection and loyalty to him as a way of life, but also as a religious person, I can now receive the gift of his text to me without being afraid of having to get it all right. The goal isn't rightness. My goal is I want to live and see the world the way Jesus did. And so Jesus looks at the Old Testament and says, yep, there's something there. And so back to the most important point, however you see the story beginning is how you see the story ending and how you see Jesus in terms of what problem he's come to solve.
Yep.
And what I'm going to say is the problem he's come to solve isn't getting invisible souls to heaven. The problem he's come to solve is the restoration of Eden and the image bearers therein.
Yeah.
Boom.
I like it.
Giddy up, sports fans. Seth Erie.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. He was here. He's flopping. He's done with Zaxby's. Come here.
Okay.
You want to do Shema for us?
I want to bless you and keep you first.
Oh, you want to do bless you and keep you first?
Yeah.
first was just my first ago.
Oh, and then I go, okay, get in here so we can see you. At least our 12 people on YouTube. All right, you ready?
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad.
Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God,
our Lord alone.
Love the Lord your God
with all your heart, soul,
mind, and strength. And love your neighbor as yourself.
Amen.
What is that voice? What is that? Is that you?
Yeah.
That voice was you?
Yes.
Was that your silly voice?
Yes, it's a silly voice. Make your turn.
Okay. All right. I love that so much. So, I have to do this or Seth will fuss at me later. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord shine his face upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance to you. And in these days, may he give us peace.
Peace.
Amen. Peace.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to this conversation. The Voxology Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that is made possible by listeners just like you. If you'd like to partner with us, you can do so at patreon.com/voxologypodcast or on Tithely, tithe.ly, search Voxology Podcast. You can interact with the hosts on Facebook/Voxology Podcast or on Instagram @Voxology Podcast and on Twitter or X, whatever it is, @MikeErie. Thank you, thank you, thank you for walking this long road with us.